Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the open rebellion in Iraq, where al-Qaeda's Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant have captured much of Ramadi and most of Fallujah, as the civil war in Syria appears to be merging with a new civil war in Iraq. An expert on Iraq, Juan Cole, a professor of modern Middle Eastern and South Asian history at the University of Michigan and author of The Ayatollahs and Democracy in Iraq, joins us to discuss the bitter legacy of the Bush-Cheney war on Iraq, where last year over 8,000 Iraqis died in sectarian violence. Then we'll look into President Obama's latest appointments to the critical Wall Street Consumer Watchdog Commission that oversees how much we pay for gas and food, the Commodity Futures Trading Commission. Michael Greenberger, the former director of the Division of Trading and Markets at the CFTC, joins us to discuss the more Wall Street-friendly commissioners President Obama is appointing, as well as who might succeed the head of consumer protection at the Federal Reserve, who is likely to be replaced by a more Wall Street-friendly appointment. Then finally, we will speak with media critic and reform advocate Robert McChesney, whose latest book, co-authored with John Nichols, is Dollarocracy: How the Money and Media Election Complex is Destroying Democracy. As this election year begins, we will discuss how unbridled campaign spending defines our politics and could signal the end of our democracy, with the growing price tag for buying a House and Senate seat up from $845,000 in 2000 to a minimum of $1.6 million in 2012. For the House, and up from $7.2 million to $10.3 million for the Senate. And joining us now is Juan Cole, who's a professor of modern Middle Eastern and South Asian history at the University of Michigan and president of the Global Americana Institute. He's the author of Sacred Space and Holy War, The Ayatollahs and Democracy in Iraq, Napoleon's Egypt, Invading the Middle East, and Engaging the Muslim World. He's also the author of the blog Inform Comment at juancole.com. Welcome to Background Briefing, Juan Cole.
Thank you, Ian.
And is it possible that the civil war in Syria is merging with this new civil war in or revived civil war in Iraq?
Well, I think the situation in the two countries is quite different. So I wouldn't call them civil wars, but certainly it is the case that the rebellion and violence in Syria has renewed the life of the Sunni extremists in northern Iraq.
And we have to put this in the context of this bloody attrition that's been going on since the U.S. pulled out, with more than 8,000 Iraqis dying in sectarian violence last year, according to the United Nations, the bloodiest year since 2008.
Yes, this death toll is a result of the revival of the low-intensity guerrilla war in Iraq. I want to underline that it's not a civil war in Iraq, because unlike what you saw in 2006-2007, when many more people died in violence, as many as 2,000 and 3,000 a month at some points, this is not neighborhood faction fighting between two sectarian groups. The violence is being pursued by a small band of guerrilla fighters who deploy sniping and car bombing and other techniques. Many of the dead are innocent bystanders who get caught up in those attacks. And so it's a war of the guerrillas on the institutions of the nascent Shiite-dominated government of Iraq.
But apparently these al-Qaeda flags are flying over key government buildings in Fallujah, most of which apparently has been captured by the rebels, if you whatever you want to call them, and also Ramadi as well, parts of that. So that, I guess, is what's getting people's attention, the idea that the government has lost control of its own territory, or if indeed it ever had control of it.
Yes, there's there's been an increase in territory held by the guerrillas in the Sunni Arab cities of Ramadi and Fallujah and Khalidiyah. These groups have been influential in some city quarters and in some areas of some provinces for a very long time now. I mean, this insurgency is nearly 10 years old. And so that's not new. What's new is that in the last 5 years, those groups had lost the ability to take and hold territory. And now they're regaining that ability. There's been a big influx of money from places like Kuwait, from private Gulf billionaires, oil billionaires, to these groups in Syria. There's been an influx of weaponry. They've gained battlefield experience from fighting the Syrian troops. These groups operate on both sides of the border. And so I think that's how the resources that they have gained in northern Syria have spilled back over into Iraq.
Again, I'm speaking with Juan Cole, who's a professor of modern Middle Eastern and South Asian history at the University of Michigan and president of the Global Americana Institute. He is the author of Sacred Space and Holy War, The Ayatollahs and Democracy in Iraq, Napoleon's Egypt, Invading the Middle East, and Engaging the Muslim World. He's also the author of the blog Informed Comment at juancole.com. So it looks as though, in retrospect now, the so-called surge that General Petraeus was credited with, it always seemed to me and others that I've spoken to that it was really only basically the means by which Bush and Cheney and Rice and Rumsfeld were able to save face. They didn't seem to know what to do. They, you know, triumphantly invaded the place, claiming that they were bringing democracy, and essentially handed it over to Iran. And when the insurgency caught them by surprise and intensified, they seemed to be at a total loss until this idea came up to bribe the Sunni in Anbar, the very people that seem to be now engaged in this fighting. And the rest is history, but it was always a cosmetic fig leaf behind which the U.S. could get out of the place. Is that the correct analysis?
Well, certainly the troop escalation that was ordered by Bush in late 2006 did not have the vast effects that its supporters have claimed for it. Actually, the U.S. troop levels just went back up to those that it had seen in 2005. So it wasn't a new amount of troops on the ground. It wasn't unprecedented. I think they did have an effect. There were a lot of firefights with the Sunni radicals. But I think the big thing that happened in that period of 2006-2007 is that there was a civil war. It was a war fought more or less under the noses of the U.S. troops in back alleys and neighborhoods where they didn't control things. And I think they played into it by because General Petraeus made a deal with Prime Minister al-Maliki to disarm the Sunni Arabs first and then to go after the Shiite radicals. And by doing that, I think he left the Sunni communities helpless. And at night, the Shiite, who were still armed, would go into neighborhoods and ethnically cleanse them. So Baghdad went from being 50-50 Sunni and Shiite when Bush invaded to probably being something on the order of 80% Shiite by the end of 2007. So the fighting and the deaths did get tamped down in Baghdad, but I think it was largely because if you were an angry Shiite and wanted to kill Sunnis, you would have had to get in your car and drive for a while to find any. And the Sunnis were displaced to other cities, even all the way to Syria and Jordan.
So when President Bush and Condoleezza Rice met with the Sunni tribal leaders in Anbar province in September of 2007, are those same Sunni tribal leaders the ones that are now joining al-Qaeda?
Well, some of them, Ahmed Abu Risha, for instance, the brother of Abdul Sattar Abu Risha, who led an Awakening Council or Sons of Iraq unit back in those days, are still around and they're still fighting al-Qaeda. And indeed, Abu Risha announced on Sunday that his forces had taken back 90% of Ramadi. I don't know whether that's true or not, but Abu Risha is attempting to reemerge as the kind of pro-government Sunni leader fighting the radicals that we had seen in the heyday of 2007. And I think almost certainly hoping that he can show himself valuable to the government of Nouri al-Maliki, which, after all, has billions in oil receipts to share around.
Well, Juan Cola, I guess the point of my earlier question was to try and get an idea of how much we still are culpable for this disaster in Iraq following the Bush-Cheney invasion. I recall the only voice inside that government that even spoke out with any kind of caution was Colin Powell, who used the famous pottery barn analogy, you know, if you break it, you own it. Well, we broke it. I believe there's still about 4 million displaced Iraqis outside of this country. The Christians have been driven out. The place has been in a low simmering bloodbath since we got out, and now there's open rebellion in Anbar province. It's just an ugly picture, and it looks as though we've sort of washed our hands and walked away, and suddenly it's no longer our responsibility.
That's right. Well, the United States has a long history of intervening violently in other countries and then walking away. We've seen it over and over again in places like Haiti and Honduras. So it's not really a new thing. It's the scale of it in Iraq is unusual. It's a big country. It's an important country. It's an oil country. But certainly the Bush administration is responsible for destabilizing the northern reaches of the Persian Gulf for probably decades to come. And I think they were going for a greater stability, a greater possibilities of pumping oil, removing sanctions on that had been put on the Saddam Hussein regime. And all of those plans have crashed and burned. Oil is still up near $100 a barrel. All these years later, we were promised $14 a barrel oil by Rupert Murdoch. The incompetence and sometimes maliciousness of the Bush administration rule of Iraq has left it a basket case. So I think we can, you know, historians don't have many prerogatives in life, Ian, but I think we can pronounce the Bush endeavor in Iraq an enormous failure, perhaps the greatest in American foreign policy.
But it still appears to have had the ironic blowback, if you will, that the U.S. has spent all these lives and treasures, and of course most of the casualties, the preponderance of casualties were Iraqis who died, and we don't quite know what the full figure is of how many Iraqis died. But the U.S. it costs what $3 trillion or something. We're not sure about that. But at the end of the day, we haven't been able to. The U.S. hasn't been able to persuade Maliki to stop the Iranians from flying arms and money into Syria. And apparently just recently, the Iraqi government, Maliki's government, halted secret U.S. Surveillance drone flights over the country. So it seems pretty clear whose side he's on. Well, he's certainly not on our side.
Well, it was foreseeable that the Shiite Iraqis would ally with the Iranian Shiites were they to take over Iraq. And so that's what's happened, actually. Nouri al-Maliki initially had indifferent relations with Iran, but as he has faced these problems of the extremist Sunni rebellion in Syria, the resurgence of Sunni extremism in northern Iraq, he has gravitated closer and closer to Iran. He also gets electricity and refined petroleum from Iran. 70% of Iran's goods getting around the U.S. sanctions on Iran now are sold to Iraq. So Iran has benefited. The Shiites of Iraq have benefited. But the security situation in Iraq has been left extremely fragile. I don't anticipate, by the way, that the government will have difficulty in taking back those towns if it puts its mind to it. It does have an army. It has deployed it successfully in Basra and elsewhere. It has helicopter gunships from the Americans. I was in Iraq last May, Ian, and I was struck by how bizarre it is, really, that the Iraqi new army wears American-style uniforms and has American weaponry. It has American tanks and armored cars and planes and so forth. So it's really a little bit surreal to watch the Iraqis deploy this military equipment. They look, you know, if you don't look closely, they look like it's an American army. So I think the army that's loyal to Nur al-Maliki will prevail in this particular fight, but the likelihood of Sunni discontents going away is low. And al-Maliki has been very bad politically about reaching out to the Sunnis, which is one of the reasons that he's having this current crisis.
And my understanding is that although there are U.S. advisors there in the vast embassy compound in Baghdad, they're not active, are they not? If they can't fly drones, it would indicate that they're not active, right?
Well, I went to the embassy. I went into the green zone when I was there in May, and I was told by the embassy staff that there's a very rapid withdrawal of personnel. I think they were expecting to be down to 5,000 or so by this time. Only a couple hundred of those are diplomats, and the rest are security people, many of them contractors. So I think that they're mainly concerned with gathering intelligence in the region and protecting the Green Zone. I very much doubt that they're in a position to help al-Maliki in any material way, except that they're giving him more weaponry. But as I said, the Iraqi army that's been created in the past few years isn't so bad. It seems actually to be able to mount operations, to take territory, to stand and fight, and they proved this as early as 2008 in Basra. So I don't worry so much about a Syria kind of situation where, you know, parts of the country go permanently out of government hands. I would be surprised if that happened. But I do think that, you know, what's going on here is that city quarters are being taken over by al-Qaeda in part because they want to be. They hate the government. They hate al-Maliki. You know, it's not much reported in our press anymore, but al-Maliki sent a SWAT team into al-Anbar province to arrest a sitting member of parliament who was a Sunni last weekend. And they dragged him off in chains, and there was a firefight at his compound, and they killed his brother. And this is a member of parliament. So 44 Sunni members of parliament submitted their resignation. You know, the government is in danger of collapsing over this kind of thing. And al-Maliki, just is like a bull in a china shop. He has no finesse. He's very unnuanced in his approach to things.
Putting it politely. Well, Juan Cole, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me in.
Again, I've been speaking with Juan Cole. He's a professor of modern Middle Eastern and South Asian history at the University of Michigan and president of the Global Americana Institute. He's the author of Sacred Space and Holy War, The Ayatollahs and Democracy in Iraq, Napoleon's Egypt Invading the Middle East, and Engaging the Muslim World. He's also the author of the blog InformComment at JuanCole.com. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about Obama's Wall Street-friendly appointments to the Commodity Futures Trading Commission. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Michael Greenberger, the former director of the Division of Trading and Markets at the Commodities Futures Trading Commission. Currently, he's the director of the Center for Health and Homeland Security at the University of Maryland, where he also teaches constitutional law and a seminar on futures, options, and derivatives at the University of Maryland School of Law. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Greenberger.
It's nice to be here, Ian.
And Gary Gensler is stepping down, or has stepped down last Friday, as the chairman of the Commodities Futures Trading Commission. And President Obama has announced his successor, Treasury Department official Timothy Massad. What's your reaction to the new leadership at the CTFC?
I'm very disappointed. I think that through a combination of appointments the president has made, the commission is the most hostile to investors than it's been in years. I would add to that, even George W. Bush appointed commissioners who were much more investor-friendly than the present crew that President Obama has put together. And by the way, they haven't been confirmed yet. I do expect there are three of them that will have to be confirmed, and I do expect that there will be pushback from progressive senators about this. You know, he wanted to make Larry Summers the chairman of the Federal Reserve, which was, you know, just to progressives, an absurdity, and progressive senators and progressive groups were able to fight that back. Larry Summers was a big target, so it was somewhat easier, but the crew he's putting together now, first of all, they don't understand the derivatives market, which is now, after Dodd-Frank, the jurisdiction is $300 trillion notional value, up from about $40 trillion notional value before Dodd-Frank. The CFTC, I'm sure your listeners have not heard a lot about it, but after Dodd-Frank was passed, it holds the most important financial regulatory position, far outdistancing, for example, the Securities Exchange Commission. And the president has essentially placed the commission in the hands of the banks.
So this is about to get worse, isn't it? Because the Bart Chilton, who is a Democratic commissioner and who's been quite harsh on Wall Street and, of course, with considerable justice there, he apparently is being replaced by Sharon Bowen, who's a corporate lawyer representing private equity and other financial institutions on Wall Street. She's supposed to take over from Bart Chilton.
Yeah.
So these are appointments that the president's making. Has Wall Street gotten to Obama?
I don't know what's happened to the president. All I can say is I know what the result is. And again, Bart Chilton, who was, you know, first of all, let me say, Gary Gensler was a phenomenal chair. He was instrumental in getting Dodd-Frank passed and making it very tough on Wall Street. He fought Wall Street tooth and nail, ironically, as a former partner in Goldman Sachs. And losing him is a big, big loss. Chilton, ironically, was first appointed by George W. Bush, believe it or not. And Obama did give him a second term early in the administration. But from where I sit, Chilton badly wanted to get another reappointment. The terms are only 5 years. And he was just stiff-armed by the White House. So he's on the way out. And President Obama, the progressive, has put in his place a conservative Wall Street lawyer who represents the vested interests. That's bad enough, but when you look at the present array of the commission, the five commissioners, all of whom have been nominated by the president, now I'm assuming that the three who have been nominated, not confirmed, will get the positions, it is the most hostile commission to investors that I remember in my lifetime.
Again, I'm speaking with Michael Greenberger, who's the former director of the Division of Trading and Markets at the Commodities Futures Trading Commission. Currently, he's the director of the Center for Health and Homeland Security at the University of Maryland, where he also teaches constitutional law and a seminar on futures, options, and derivatives at the University of Maryland School of Law. So, try and help me out here, because I don't understand, Michael Greenberger, why this president, whose political future and the political future of the Democratic Party has depended upon the recovery of this economy. And one of the things that most slows down the economy, apart from the insane antics of the Tea Party on the Hill, is the fact that because of lax regulations, Wall Street is able to game the most important commodities that the average American depends upon, and that is food on the table and gasoline in the car. And the idea that these speculators on Wall Street can drain the pockets of the average American for no good done to the economy, in fact, harm done to the economy, which slows down our growth and slows down our recovery and unnecessarily impoverishes working Americans and middle-class Americans. Isn't that a fundamental issue?
It's a fundamental issue. And by the way, it's not just Americans. The third world, the starvation factor in the third world has been exponentially increased by the driving up of food prices through the manipulation of commodity markets. The other thing I would say, and it's not just gas and food, there are all sorts of financial instruments that deal with interest rates, foreign currency, et cetera. There are now about a dozen investigations around the world where the banks have been accused of manipulating markets, fixing interest rates to their betterment, fixing foreign exchange to their betterment. There are open criminal investigations going on, not just by the United States, but around the world. So this is a very volatile, harmful market. Congress, when it passed Dodd-Frank, and I think thinking that Gary Gensler would be there to oversee it, gave this agency tremendous jurisdiction. The new chair was in charge of the TARP program, the giveaway money to the banks, and he was also in charge of the HARP program, which was supposed to be a mortgage forgiveness program, and it's been the most fundamentally unsuccessful. If any of your listeners know anybody who's been helped with their mortgages, I'll be shocked, because the administration has done next to nothing. So the man who's done TARP and the man who hasn't provided mortgage relief to people who are being foreclosed upon is being handed this chairmanship without any record at all of dealing in the instruments that are subject to the jurisdiction.
Well, isn't that at the heart of why the economy has slowed so much and it's been so hard on Main Street? While, ironically, the people who almost tanked the global economy, Wall Street, have been made whole. My understanding is that TARP and all of this stuff, including these quantitative easings, is about buying up all this worthless paper that led to the crash of 2008. And that isn't that what's happening?
Well, yes, that led to the crash. But now, you know, the Fed, our Federal Reserve, is buying that paper up. And when you look at the subsidy that the banks were given, and many official reports have been written about this, TARP was only $800 billion, but the total with quantitative easing and everything else, it's been a $12.3 trillion gift to the banks. And the banks have no interest in performing their fundamental job, what we conventionally think of banks doing, which is loaning to people at reasonable interest rates, who want to start businesses, who want to grow businesses, who want to go to get student loans, et cetera, et cetera. And they, whatever they're doing, they're refusing giving loans to small businesses. They are the student loan situation. If we have another financial crisis, it's going to be because students cannot possibly pay off their loans, just like homeowners couldn't pay off their mortgages. There are trillions and trillions of dollars in student loans out there. And because the economy is so bad, there's a huge unemployment rate of the so-called millennial generation, those people in their 20s and early 30s. And the next bubble is almost certainly going to be their default on these student loans, just as homeowners defaulted on their mortgages. And the final thing I would say, the president's cavalier attitude toward who he's putting on the CFTC, embedded in that is an assumption that we're never going to have another crash. And I think many people, respectable people, Nobel Prize winners, what have you, feel that our economy is just as vulnerable today as it was in 2007, which led into the fundamental crash of 2008. So the president's got 3 years, roughly 3 years to go, and he's really playing with matches by not focusing on getting the banks into a confined relationship where they aren't betting on things and trying to fix the casino. And already his activities have badly damaged the Democratic Party. After the shutdown, it looked like the Democrats would take back the House. But basically, on the radar screen, is the fumbling with Obamacare has completely reversed that situation. But not on the radar screen, but what is there is what you and I are talking about, is that the environment is such that we could go through, while the president is still in office, another kind of calamity that we experienced in September of 2008. And by the way, there isn't $12.3 trillion left to do the next saving gesture to the banks. We were told in 2008 if we didn't expend that money, we would have gone through a Great Depression, the equivalent of what happened in the 1930s. And if there's another crash and no money to save financial institutions, what essentially is on the table is not having 7% unemployment, or the real unemployment rate is something like 14% when you count people who've given up looking for jobs or are underemployed, but you're looking at the kinds of unemployment where there were breadlines in the 1930s. And, you know, the interesting thing is about the 9/11 attacks. The commission who investigated that said it was a failure of imagination. It was a failure to conceive that that kind of event would take place. And what we are seeing now with the president is a failure of imagination. If he had insight into these problems, he would be taking a completely different posture with regard to the economy and regulation. And he's running the risk that he will be the next Herbert Hoover.
Again, I'm speaking with Michael Greenberger, the former director of the Division of Trading and Markets at the Commodities Futures Trading Commission. When you said earlier, Michael, that the CTFC is in many ways more important than the Securities Exchange Commission, and we know in both cases the Republicans cut funds for enforcement, both at the SEC and at the Commodities Futures Trading Commission as well, because when the president presented this new leader that he's nominated, Timothy Massad, who comes from out of Treasury, who dealt with both TARP and HARP, as you pointed out, he mentioned the need for funding for enforcement. Explain to our audience why the Commodity Futures Trading Commission is important and how much its regulation affects their pocketbooks.
Well, first of all, as we've already talked about, what the CFTC, or Commodity Futures Trading Commission, does has a direct impact on the cost of food and the cost of gasoline, which is a key indicator of inflation or money that's taken out of the pockets of consumers. But beyond that, every time you take out a loan, you know, an interest rate is established, and the CFTC is investigating the fact that through devious means, the banks are fixing interest rate charges. They're fixing the charge of foreign currency. They can only do this if they get appropriated funds from Congress. And a strategy that the Republicans have gotten onto is sort of a bank shot of deregulation by just completely underfunding the SEC and the CFTC. There is a movement, you know, the Federal Reserve, and for that matter, the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau, which is in the Fed, they don't get appropriations. They charge the people they regulate, the banks they regulate, for their appropriated funds. There's been a movement among progressives, Democrats in the House and Senate, to have the SEC and the CFTC not dependent on Congress's appropriations, but to charge small amounts of money, a tenth of a percentage point on transactions that would give these agencies the funding to do the job they have to do. I told you the CFTC has a $300 trillion notional value jurisdiction. There's 600 employees in the CFTC. There are fewer employees there today than when Gary Gensler walked in the door in 2009. So we're asking these 600 employees to monitor over $300 trillion notional value investments. And, you know, Gensler said that they really should have 1,300 employees, not 600 employees. But again, you know, the consumer, the investor, the taxpayer is being hammered by all this. But because we have a president who either doesn't want to explain it or doesn't understand it himself, the average American doesn't know what's going on. And what is going on is the financial stability not only of the United States, but the world economy is being put at risk. And the thesis that what we went through in 2008 is going to be ancient history never to be repeated is a fallacy. It could happen next month, it could happen next year, and there's a damn good chance it'll happen before the president leaves office. Mossad is an unknown character, but anybody who was responsible for HARP, which has been a complete unhelpful program to foreclosed homeowners, you're putting people in important jobs who just are likely, at best, to not care, and at worst, to be the handmaiden to the banks. So we've got, on the one hand, it's not a completely bleak picture with Yellen and Liu, but it just is not playing out the way it should play out. And the problem is, you know, you can say, well, we'll wait for the next president. Maybe Hillary Clinton will be better. Some people think Elizabeth Warren could be the next president. She would be terrific. She understands these issues. But we got 3 years to go. And bad things, as I've said earlier, can happen. And that's the real fear. I should also say, for people listening in California, that Senator Feinstein has been a very aggressive advocate for effective financial regulation. And I'm hoping very much, she's already laid down some markers about being unhappy about the CFTC appointments. I'm hoping that she and Senator Warren and Senator Cantwell and Senator Blumenthal and Senator Bernie Sanders will coalesce the way they coalesced in opposition to the Larry Summers nomination and beat these nominations back.
Well, just in closing, Michael Greenberger, in a 2010 interview with the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, Sandra Brownstein, who's stepping down as the Fed's consumer protection representative and will be replaced, and as I mentioned, apparently they're putting out the feelers from Wall Street, asking them for some suggestions of who might replace her. She said, when she was asked about what the Fed should have done in the early 2000s to rein in this deceptive mortgage practices that led to the 2008 crash, she said, "I really don't remember having thoughts along those lines."
Yes.
That's pretty depressing.
Well, you know, and as you said, my goodness, Sheila Bair, I think she was then an obscure assistant secretary of the Treasury. By the way, Sheila Bair's a Republican. George Bush made her an assistant secretary of the Treasury. George Bush put her in charge of the FDIC. And as you correctly pointed out, Sheila Bair went to Greenspan and said to him, if you don't get, and he had jurisdiction to do it, if you don't get on top of these subprime mortgages, you're going to have a calamity. And he completely ignored her. And by the way, the Obama administration has completely ignored her. They were happy to see her, Sheila Bair, leave the FDIC. They did not support her when she was in that position. Timothy Geithner was at war with her through his entire term. And as you know, my former boss, Brooksley Bourne, who was the one who pointed out that these unregulated derivatives could destabilize the economy, she's sitting on the sidelines, too. So, and these are either Democrats or progressives. They have no entree into the Obama administration. And that's very, very sad, because they're good people who are out there. Sheila Bair and Brooksley Bourne in the late 90s and early 2000s pointed out what would cause the meltdown, and no one would listen. And I think that we've got a better Secretary of the Treasury now and a better Chairman of the Federal Reserve, but you can't put five people on the CFTC who don't care in the slightest about the American economy and only care about being on the good side of the banks, probably because they're hoping when they leave their job, they will slide into a very lucrative Wall Street position.
Well, thank you so much for joining us here today, Michael Greenberger.
You're welcome, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Michael Greenberger, who's the former director of the Division of Trading and Markets at the Commodities Futures Trading Commission. Currently, he's the director of the Center for Health and Homeland Security at the University of Maryland, where he also teaches constitutional law and a seminar on futures options and derivatives at the University of Maryland School of Law. And we're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking with media critic and reform advocate Robert McChesney about the money race in this election year.
The peddlers and the meddlers, they buy and they sell. They destroyed your city, they'll destroy you as well. The lecherous and treacherous, a hair meant for leather. Each of them bigger than all men put together. Sluggers and muggers, wearing fancy gold.
Cash rules everything around me. Cream, get the money. Dollar, dollar bill, yo. Cash rules everything around me. Cream, get the money. Dollar, dollar bill, yo. Cash rules everything around me. Cream, get the money. Dollar, dollar bill, yo. Cash rules everything around me. Cream, get the money. Dollar, dollar bill, yo.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Robert McChesney, who is the Gutzel Endowed Professor in the Department of Communications at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. He, along with John Nichols, co-founded the media reform organization Free Press, and Robert McChesney and John Nichols have co-authored The Death and Life of American Journalism, The Media Revolution That Will Begin the World Again, Will the Last Reporter Turn Out the Lights, The Collapse of Journalism and What Can Be Done to Fix It, and their latest book is Dollarocracy, How the Money and Media Election Complex is Destroying America. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert McChesney.
My pleasure, Ian.
And you and John came up with the calculated a record-breaking $10 billion was spent in the 2012 election campaign, much of it on political advertising. And while there have been other figures that are seven-something billion, give us your reasoning as to why your figure is more accurate than the lesser figure, which is bad enough to begin with.
Well, the reason is that the lesser figure that is used is usually only includes federal races, congressional and presidential. And I think that figure that was given was originally $6 billion. It's been upgraded to $7 billion since then. And our initial figure was $10 billion because we included state, local, referenda, judicial races. And also, we're probably closer to $11 billion now. In the last year, a lot of spending has come forward in the filings that have been done. And that's one of the things that's striking about spending in elections in America compared to virtually all other democracies, which is the reporting rules are so lax and the enforcement so lax that we still will never know exactly how much was spent. It's probably much, even more than we know. It keeps going up. As I said, we're closing in on $11 billion now. And I should also say, to put this into context compared to other countries, you know, Germany held national elections a few months ago and elected a new government. And for every dollar German politicians spent and parties and donors and politicians spent per voter in Germany in their national elections, in 2012, the United States, just for our congressional and presidential races, the equivalent, spent $35 per voter. We're outspending Germany 35-1, and Germany is the norm. That's how it is the rest of the world. We're the outlier.
Well, according to the Campaign Finance Institute, the average cost of winning a House seat has risen to about $1.6 million from 2012, which is 2 years late, these figures, up from $845,000 in 2000. And for the Senate, the average cost now in 2012, I should say, is $10.3 million, up from $7.2 million in 2000. So we there's considerable inflation there, wouldn't you say?
I'd say, and also I think something to keep in mind is that for the House seats in particular, those average figures don't mean a lot because around two-thirds of the races for the House of Representatives are gerrymandered. So there's really not any contest there, and there doesn't need to be much spending. their racism, which the parties have divvied it up. In California, I think, has less of that now than most states. Like Wisconsin, where I live most of the year, has been, even though it's a 50-50 state in terms of voters and Republican-Democrat, more or less, or slightly more Democratic, in our congressional races, they're virtually all landslides for one part or the other. They divided it up, so there's really no contest. And as a result of that, if you look at the House races, for just the competitive races, the ones that are not gerrymandered into being sort of one-party state districts, then the figures are dramatically higher than what you gave.
Again, I'm speaking with Robert McChesney, who is the Gussell Endowed Professor in the Department of Communications at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. He, along with John Nichols, co-founded the media reform organization Free Press, and they've written together The Death and Life of American Journalism, The Media Revolution That Will Begin the World Again, Will the Last Reporter Turn Out the Lights, The Collapse of Journalism and What Can Be Done to Fix It, and their latest book is Dollarocracy, How the Money and Media Election Complex is Destroying America. Now, apparently some of the congressmen and senators are getting more creative with their money-raising efforts. It's no longer the de rigueur rubber chicken political fundraising dinners, but Senator Lindsey Graham will entertain you with Elvis impersonators. Senator David Vitter of Louisiana will invite you to hunt alligators for $5,000. And in your state of Wisconsin, Bob, the Lumberjack World Championships apparently featured hometown Republican Congressman and former Lumberjack Sean Duffy. You could join him, chop down some trees for a $1,000 per person or $2,000 per political action committee. So is this what we have to look forward to, entertainment instead of rubber chickens?
Well, you know, I think that's actually fairly benign compared to what the real action is going on. You know, the sort of stuff you just described, Ian, is stuff that's basically pitched maybe at 2 to 5% of the population that has the sort of money that could afford to drop a few thousand dollars on a race, and it wouldn't really affect their standard of living, that sort of disposable income, to do that routinely on races. And that's bad enough as it is. It means that effectively the top few percent of the American population are the relevant people for these politicians. But I think what we're seeing that's far more insidious, and what we chronicle in the book, is that with the post-Citizens United era in particular, where there's really no accountability, we're seeing very wealthy individuals throw money into politics that would make a mockery of the lumberjack people dropping $1,000 or $2,000. I mean, they're dropping, in the case of the Koch brothers, $200 or $300 million on the 2012 election cycle. In the case of Shelley Adelson, maybe a couple $100 million. And in the cases like this, it's not just the national races. We focus oftentimes on the president or the Senate races or even House races. But sometimes the worst damage comes on judicial races or referenda races at the local and state level or city council and mayor races, where a powerful interest can now go in if it's got a stake in an issue and just flood a race with money. And since there's no journalism coverage to speak of for the most part of most races, they can effectively buy an outcome.
So, Robert McChesney, as you pointed out in your new book, Dollarocracy, how the money and media election complex is destroying America, that the last election year it cost at least $10 billion, and this coming election year, it's an off year, but it could cost considerably, certainly more than it used to cost. And most of this money goes to political advertising. So doesn't the mainstream media here basically, aren't they benefiting from a broken system? Because if during these elections everybody's clamoring for media time to flood the airwaves with advertising, and now because of Citizens United, the billionaires don't have to attribute it to the fact that they're behind these phony front groups. Isn't the media itself unlikely to want to reform a process from which they are making a fortune?
Indeed. In fact, that's one of the arguments of our book. The subtitle of our book talks about the money and media election complex that's destroying America.
And a key part of our argument is that commercial television broadcasters and corporate media have, you know, they are like the equivalent of military contractors to the military-industrial complex, because the vast majority of this $11 billion goes to TV ads, the majority of it. The closer the race, the higher the percentage. And these ads are basically manna from heaven for the handful of companies that own all the TV stations in the country. For example, in 1992, the average U.S. commercial TV station got maybe 2 or 3% of its total revenues from candidate political advertising. By 2012, depending on the market you were looking at, the amount went usually in the 15 to 20% at the low end to the 35 to 40% at the high end of all revenues, total revenues for the year came from political advertising. I mean, this has been, and the Wall Street analysts who assess this have all been quite candid about it. This has made commercial broadcasting in this country extraordinarily profitable and lucrative. Because it's basically a huge subsidy of this industry, this huge source of money. And it, just as the amount of advertising has increased with these inane and offensive ads, TV ads, I might add, for candidates, which are illegal in most democracies, they're regarded as toxic propaganda. But just as the airways are flooded with these ads in America, at the same time, commercial news media connected to radio and television has basically stopped covering politics.
Well, but that only leaves the alternative media, and that's not particularly strong in America.
You know, that's such a great point. We talk about this at some length in the book, too. In most other democracies, certainly in the West, Western Europe, and in East Asia, like Japan, you have very strong nonprofit, non-commercial radio and television sectors, which cover politics extensively. And as a result, the commercial broadcasters sort of have to get their act together to stay in the game. That's one of the reasons, for example, the Guardian newspaper claims its political coverage is good. It's because it knows the BBC is there, sort of a non-commercial competitive alternative. And in the United States, our public broadcasting and community broadcasting has been very undernourished and has not done a very good job, even with what nourishment they've had, of covering politics. And what's most regrettable, I think, is that community radio broadcasting, which includes stations like the Pacifica chain, they've tried at times and sometimes done superior work, but increasingly I think they're really overwhelmed too, and they can barely make a dent in sort of all the commercial propaganda. You know, I recently have been reading about changes, you know, at Pacifica, which is really the, I think, the flagship of community broadcasting, not only in the United States, but in the world. It's been such a central role and bringing issues to light for decades, generations that wouldn't get covered otherwise. And now it looks like there's a threat, from what I can see, that Pacifica may discontinue this mission of being this feisty advocate of the dispossessed and turn more into sort of some sort of new age operation, which is a very dubious value. I'm not an expert on this, but what I'm reading about it gives me cause for concern. I don't know if you want to say anything about this, Ian.
Unfortunately, I'm under a gag order here. I was recently suspended, and I've been told that if I say anything about what's happening at Pacifica, I'll immediately be fired. So I'd like to answer your question.
Please don't, then. I don't want you to be fired.
Okay. So, again, Rob McChesney, the author with John Nichols of Dollarocracy, How the Money and Media Election Complex is Destroying America. What's your sense, then, given the limitations of getting the real word out, and obviously our elections are no longer about candidates and ideas, they're about money. You know, I remember people like William Proxmire, who would be routinely reelected in, I think, again, your state, Wisconsin, for a budget of $500 per cycle. That's all he would spend. What was his magic, and why don't we have people like Proxmire? I know we have Bernie Sanders, but a lot of that's to do with the state of Vermont.
You know, one of the things we do in the book is we look at the evolution of this modern election system, of this reliance on big money and television advertising. And what was striking to us, and really I wasn't familiar with this until I did the research of the book, was how in the 1960s, really across the board, serious politicians from Barry Goldwater to Lyndon Johnson and JFK, both parties understood that the emerging money system of TV advertising was antithetical to anything remotely close to democracy. This was something that really concerned them. There was tremendous incentive and consensus that we needed to do something about it. We needed to corral this money system quickly. In fact, that was one of the primary motivations for creating PBS in the United States in the first place. One of the things that really got the publics behind the idea was the idea that there'd be a place where politics would be covered and there wouldn't be any TV ads. So there was a real tradition in America of understanding this is a problem. It wasn't just a few principled people, but everyone got it. Richard Nixon was concerned about this in the 1960s. Everyone who was really serious about politics got that this was a problem. The Wall Street Journal was editorializing about the need for free airtime to limit the amount of advertising. And I think what happened was we had a moment where it looked like reform was going to come through that peaked in the early 1970s. And then in 1976, the Supreme Court, in a very famous case called Buckley v. Vallejo, basically started the whole process that ended up in Citizens United, which said the governments couldn't really regulate elections as they traditionally had done in American history if it interfered with the right of rich people and corporations to buy elections. And that was the whole process that was begun. And once that begun, the ability to have effective legislation to set up fair, level playing field elections was lost in America. That's where we are today.
And that began equating one vote with $1. And Buckley v. Vallejo is at the heart, of, as you mentioned, of subsequent legislation. Of course, all have been removed with – almost all have been removed with Citizens United, and now we've got this other one, McCutcheon, too. So there's no question the direction that the court is taking this. I'm left here only saying, Bob, that I look forward to hosting you this coming Thursday at the UCLA Hammer Forum, where we can discuss this even further. Well, we're not ending on a decisive note here, but I know there's a lot more to be said.
There is indeed, and I hope everyone comes out to it. John and I love talking about these issues, and we'll be glad to talk to people as long as they want to talk to us.
Well, again, I thank you for joining us, Robert McChesney.
My pleasure, Ian. Have a good day.
You too. Again, I've been speaking with Robert McChesney, who is the Gutzel Endowed Professor in the Department of Communications at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. He, along with John Nichols, co-founded the media reform organization Free Press, and they are the authors of Death and Life of American Journalism, The Media Revolution That Will Begin the World Again, Will the Last Reporter Turn Out the Lights, The Collapse of Journalism, and What Can Be Done to Fix It? And their latest book is Dollarocracy, How the Money and Media Election Complex is Destroying America. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time was